Good evening. Welcome to Front Page Boston on WBCA 102.9. My name is Yao Miller. I'm the senior editor at the Bay State Banner.
And I'm Bill Forey. I'm the editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Every week here on Front Page Boston, we dive into the stories that are making headlines in the Bay State Banner, the Reporter, and other media across the city. We're looking at stories that obviously impact the neighborhoods of the city, but also that transcend the city and go into greater Boston and beyond. And let's start this week with some breaking news, at least it was overnight, about the Boston Globe property in Dorchester, which is an enormously important redevelopment opportunity and an important business story as well, with the Boston Globe poised to move to new headquarters in downtown Boston within the next month or so. This is now the second time in 4 years that a anticipated sale of the Dorchester property has fallen through.
And as you reported, this is not going to affect their move. They're still moving downtown.
That's right.
The Globe is.
They are. But this is an important business transaction for John Henry and the Globe, the Boston Globe empire, to the property itself was going to be sold, we understand, for over $80 million. And if you consider that John Henry, when he purchased the Boston Globe, purchased it in 2013, I believe it was, for $70 million for everything, not only the newspaper, but the building and all the associated parts of the Globe empire media organization, a very important business transaction. But in the Dorchester context, obviously, this is a big story because this is a 16-acre site on Morrissey Boulevard, nestled between Savin Hill and Columbia Point Peninsula, which is really the opportunity for transformational growth and new amenities along the boulevard, something envisioned by city planners and especially neighborhood planners from the community level. For more than a decade now, people have been anticipating the idea that the Globe could move, the Globe could close or whatever, and what are we then going to do with that property? Now, the Globe had a had an agreement in place 4 years ago to sell to a development firm based up in Concord, Massachusetts, the Wynn Stanley Company. That was in place for about a year, and then that collapsed. We were told it was because of financing. Last summer, after an interim period of about 18 months, the Globe came under agreement again to be sold, this time to a New York-based firm called Center Court, which really doesn't have much of a track record in Boston, but is a major player in New York City. Nobody would tell anybody, including the Globe reporters, what was exactly included in this arrangement, what exactly was the price tag, although we are told it was more than $80 million. And more importantly, from the local perspective, no one knows at this moment what was to be done with this property once it changed hands. Would it become a mixed-use project with retail and housing as envisioned by neighbors? Would it be something else that nobody has really considered? And all of this happening, I should say, in the context of a lot of other tumult on Columbia Point, mainly on the UMass campus. So this collapse of this deal now brings in a whole new question of how is the Boston Globe under John Henry's leadership, and I should say Linda Pizzuti Henry as well, who is his wife but has been very involved in the running of the company, what are they going to do next?
Soccer stadium?
Soccer stadium is probably not going to be at the top of the list for a few different reasons.
Yeah.
But the Globe COO, a man named Sean Cohen, who I spoke to this morning, he's the person speaking publicly for the company. He didn't rule it out. He didn't rule anything out, though, I should say. And interestingly, he told me that the Boston Globe, including, you know, is open to the idea of doing this themselves, that could be part of the next phase here. Maybe John Henry, Linda Pizzuti Henry, will redevelop this land on their own with a partner, perhaps, but won't sell it, in other words. That's a possibility here.
It's sort of a long game because we're, I think, you know, at or near the crest of this real estate bubble.
Right.
If the market tanks, then you know that could put things off for the Globe another 10 years, as far as that deal goes, as far as recouping some of the money that Henry put up for the newspaper and the land.
Right, and obviously he's since that investment of $70 million. He's pumped a lot of new money into the Boston Globe over the last several years. A lot of, even though they have trimmed some staff, they've made a lot of hires as well. And of course, they've now been building out in a new building, which they'll be leasing parts of downtown in Boston on what used to be Newspaper Row. So it's a bit of a homecoming down in the near the financial district is where this will be located. And so there's a lot of money at stake. And really, from the neighborhood perspective, the future of what could be envisioned as a whole new neighborhood, really, along Morrissey Boulevard, is very much in play. So a lot of, we spoke to several neighborhood leaders, civic leaders today who are very concerned. City Councilor Frank Baker expressed frustration, but also said, look, we really need to take a look at the master plan, which was created and was published back in 2011. It's getting a little bit dated. A lot of us feel, and I'll say us because it includes the reporter, we've editorialized to this point, that there really should be a refresh button hit on the plan for Columbia Point, including the Globe site, to really come up with a new strategy for how this very important part of the city will be created, recreated in the coming years. So that's it on the Globe story. Let's talk.
I just want to segue into something real briefly. But the Boston Globe did a pretty good job today of reporting on Wednesday on traffic. Specifically with new development projects, not including the Globe site. Essentially, they tallied on major projects, including South Boston at the old power plant, South Bay in Dorchester, on the Dorchester southeast side, altogether about 25,000 new vehicle trips per day for Boston.
Wow.
When these projects are done. It's a huge strain on the traffic. It's something that we're going to be looking into in the banner for next week's edition. Just how some of the development that's planned for Roxbury will affect traffic, and what's the city doing as far as a comprehensive plan on traffic, which we haven't seen much of in recent years.
Well, there has been quite an engagement process with Boston 2030, and that's been part of their strategy. With I believe they call it the Vision Zero plan that they hope will help mitigate, safety in terms of reducing the speed limit to 25 miles per hour on most streets, for instance. But that doesn't really get at the congestion issue and what do you do with new vehicles and how do you make it safer for folks who aren't in vehicles?
Yeah.
And part of that is an ongoing conversation. And then we've seen, and this is another story that's in the reporter today, civic leaders and community grassroots group really not waiting around for answers and coming up with some of their own. We report on the front page about a new project that came out of the Greater Ashmont Main Streets Organization at their meeting last night, which is about transforming the tunnel cap that runs along the top of the red line from Fields Corner to Ashmont, which is just basically the top of a tunnel.
Yeah, and really, like at Fields Corner, it's still above ground. It kind of goes underground. The red line goes underground, and it picks up at about Park Street.
Street, exactly.
So it would basically be much in the same way that Southwest Corridor Park has a bike path.
Exactly.
This would be the bike path with the tracks directly underneath.
Yeah, and it's interesting because this proposal has really been cooked up by the Main Streets Organization, along with a local developer businessman. Who's been active in Fields Corner, as well as road architects, which have been instrumental in developing a lot of the big projects in Dorchester lately, Dot Block, for instance. So this is like local business leaders teaming up with a civic organization to say, here's a way that we could make this part of Dorchester better, safer. This is obviously MBTA property that they want to take and transform into a greenway with new amenities and bike lanes and that kind of thing. It sounds like a great idea, and if people want to check it out, they can look online at our website, dotnews.com, and get a view of the presentation that was given at the meeting last night. But again, it speaks to this idea of, people are getting frustrated. They're looking for new solutions, and they're not always going to wait around for government to come along with it, and that's an encouraging sign.
Yeah. I want to turn to the front page of the Bay State Banner, an article, Divisions in Political Base Present Challenge for Walsh. Kind of started looking at an article that appeared in the Boston Herald last week where one of Walsh's supporters, who's a longtime union activist, formerly with the Carmen's Union, now retired, Bobby Sauce Callahan, talked about his split with the Democratic Party. And Joe Fitzgerald wrote the column, said Democratic Party, Callahan didn't leave the Democratic Party. It left him.
Right.
It got me thinking and looking at, first of all, how did Boston vote for Donald Trump? There were some precincts where, citywide, he got about 13.8% of the vote, but there were precincts in Dorchester, South Boston, some in East Boston as well, that went, 40, as high as 46% for Trump. So that precinct that voted 46% for Donald Trump is about not even a mile from where we're sitting here in Lower Mills, Dorchester.
Yeah.
Ward 16 has a very conservative pockets, has several very conservative pockets. A lot of firefighters, a lot of cops. And they're also an important part of the mayor's political base. When the mayor ran, when Martin Walsh ran for mayor for the first time in 2013, that same precinct in Ward 16, I think it's precinct 12.
That's Florian Hall. That's one of the Florian Hall precincts, yeah.
Yeah. It went 86.8% for Walsh. Mm-hmm. So it was, at the same time it voted, gave Trump the highest number, it also gave Walsh the highest number in the city. And there are several precincts like that, throughout Ward 16 and also in South Boston, Wards 6 and 7.
Yeah.
Where, it was a high Trump vote, and it kind of like also corresponds to a high Walsh vote. In 16, in Ward 16, Walsh got his highest margin of victory. He got 76% of the vote. Now, Conley kind of held it down in West Roxbury and also a lot of the wealthier parts of the city. He got about 76% of the vote in Back Bay, Beacon Hill. Not a high turnout in a municipal election in that neighborhood. It's a lot of, wealthy people who are transients, don't really think of Boston as home. They're more likely to vote for president than they are for mayor. But in order to offset his losses in parts of the city like Charlestown, East Boston, and in West Roxbury, Walsh was able to really get a lot of traction in the black community. A lot of black elected officials, most black elected officials, turned out for Walsh, endorsed
Walsh.
In the final, right. And it was a turnaround for him. He was pulling behind by a lot of measures, and then came out 3 points ahead. So it was a pretty thin victory, pretty thin margin of victory. And it was, it was his ability to reach out to and appeal to black and Latino voters that really helped put him over. And so in this article, I'm looking at how does that hold together? Now you've got these different pressures. Trump is kind of a divisive, a divisive force in not just in Boston politics, but all over the country. You're seeing a lot more hate expressions of hate, and even on and at the same time, the Black Lives Matter movement, that's kind of post 2013, post like the last mayoral election. Many people of color are calling for greater oversight of police, civilian review board, body worn cameras, more hiring of minority police officers, all of which the police unions have opposed. And again, so that's, one side of Walsh's support base at odds with another side of Walsh's support base. So
it's a tricky line for him to walk. But and you mentioned this in the article too. In some respects, he's very fortunate so far in this election, in that everybody sees him as the heavy duty favorite. These disaffected voters, of which Sauce Callahan became the kind of the poster boy last week in that Boston Herald article that you cited.
Right.
There are a column of people like that who. And many of them were very enthusiastic about that article, and they're people who are representative of the labor union in that part of Dorchester and Ward 16 and 13 in particular, blue collar, white, construction and civil service unions, fire, police, who are very upset and uncomfortable with the Elizabeth Warrens and the Hillary Clintons of the party. Specifically, those are the two that were mentioned.
Right.
But you have to believe that that translates down to the local level in some form. And for Marty Walsh, you know, it's a dicey proposition to now, because to your point, he has to win people of color in the city. He has to win them to become the mayor.
Right.
It's not a question of what share. He has to win the majority, in my view. He is somebody who feels that he can. But it makes it harder when his natural base, which is frankly much less progressive than the mayor.
Much less progressive than he is, yeah.
Than he is, and much less progressive than his stated policies. For instance, giving safe haven to illegal immigrants, right. Undocumented immigrants. And that whole tension of whether to even use that word speaks to the crux of the issue. That Sauce Callahan voter in Savin Hill, his old school base, which elected him to be state representative since 1997, has a different set of expectations.
And there's one issue that could potentially unite the Sauce Callahans of the world and, you know, folks in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan. That's housing prices. Because the mayor's base there from South Boston, you know, through Savin Hill, is being hollowed out by you know, increasing rents that are just out of control, out of reach for any working people, and then, you know, you can't buy a house in those areas.
And those who can are increasingly concerned, as you mentioned earlier, about density, what it means for moving around, for where they're going to park their car, the simple quality of life things that come with a booming city, and so there are people who are with Marty Walsh 4 years ago who were very unhappy with development in, say, South Boston, didn't like the way it's transpired, thought he should have been tougher on restricting density and parking issues and things like that. But will it cost him an election? I mean, from this vantage point, no. But it'll partly depend on how he reacts to this sort of pushback, to this sort of outward, essentially people forsaking the Democratic Party at large. Will he get caught up in any of that?
Yeah, I mean, he can't, he has to win this election by a large margin, or he's going to look weak. And, Tito Jackson, his opponent in this race, has seized on affordable housing and then also education, as two of the issues that he's going to be championing. I think he's got traction with those issues. Education, it's interesting to note that the teachers union in Boston is, you know, fighting for a contract. The cops got theirs, firefighters got theirs. The teachers union is in a very public spat now with the mayor's office around, you know, they want an outside mediator. They say the city's stalling. So
it'll be interesting because, you know, all three of those unions that you mentioned have a sizable chunk of their membership that don't live in the city anymore. That's one factor. The BTU especially has a sizable chunk because they're not included in a residency requirement at all.
And they can't afford to.
That's true, too, for many. But other service employee unions that are in league and allied with them do, and especially SEIU, which has several different, obviously, branches, and they're mobilized, and they're in lockstep with each other. So that can play later on. The mayor has said he's disappointed that the BTU has gone to arbitration, noted that, hey, police and fire didn't. We were able to work it out. And, again, that speaks to that disconnect there.
Yeah,
you know, police and fire are a very different set of issues, and the mayor, that the fact that he was able to navigate them with relative ease can also work against him in some respects. So, very interesting article. I recommend anyone who's tuned into this mayor's race at any level to read Yahoo Miller's piece on the cover of the Banner. It's also online. BayStateBanner.com. Another article on the cover of the Banner, which is very interesting to me and I'm sure to a lot of our listeners, is this outrageous spat that's enveloped this charter school in Malden, which decided that it would be wise policy to restrict how young women especially can wear their hair, and especially young women of color, girls of color, little girls, and whether or not they can be allowed to wear braids in their hair.
So Mystic Valley Charter School, they basically pulled out girls with braids, and they're basically like targeting kids with extensions.
Yeah.
And presumably extensions that are in braid form and not just, you know, woven into straightened hair. So
they know.
Yeah, they're questioning these kids. Is your hair real or is it extensions? Just highly offensive to girls. Highly offensive to anybody to do
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely.
And so that kind of really strict disciplinary attitude, among some, in some corners of the education sphere, today it's jarring to people. Mm-hmm. And, particularly, black folks, really came out strongly against this. So it's something, you see this in other cities at times, in other schools, people, like basically black girls being told how to wear their hair. Some schools don't want you to wear your hair natural, like no afros. And some of them are saying, this one's saying no braids if it's extensions. So really disturbing.
Well, it prompted a huge response. Obviously, the Boston Globe broke the story last week. It prompted the ACLU to get involved in sending a letter, basically
right.
challenging them and indicating they're going to initiate a court challenge.
Yeah.
The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights here in Boston, which has been very active on a whole range of matters lately, took them to task in a very sharply worded letter, as did a number of elected officials who jumped out and said, just calling, just throwing a flag on this seems patently ill, conceived and ill-timed for sure, but
right. And
no
then the,
good
the,
time. Really.
The Massachusetts Association of Charter Schools disavowed this too. So it's kind of like you're really like all your allies have kind of turned their backs on you.
More
it's time to reconsider that policy.
You would think, but this school does seem to have a track record of being, almost taking pride in this sort of we'll go a different direction attitude, and mounted a defense of this policy initially,
right.
At least. I think they've probably have figured out that's not a good idea, but we'll see. It's still developing story. You can read it in the Banner, and it continues to be covered elsewhere too, which is good. Needs to be some focus on this sort of thing. Another story that I think I'd like to mention briefly that came up in the Reporter. It's somewhat related, I suppose. Mike Keeney, who's a community service officer here in C-11, which is one of the police districts that covers Dorchester, took this moment and really triggered, I think, by the Adam Jones incident at Fenway Park, to reflect on what the harm that can come to people from words that are intentionally meant to discriminate and to
yeah.
injure people based on who they are. And Mike wrote poignantly in the Reporter this week about his own experience just after the nightclub shooting in Orlando last year, in which he encountered people in his coffee shop talking pejoratively about gay people and said basically, oh, that was terrible, but it was just gays who got hurt. And Mike, whose son is a gay man and married to his partner, his husband, took great offense. He's a Boston police officer who perhaps some folks wouldn't expect to hear him object. But Mike not only objected, he called the guy out.
Yeah.
And in this column that he wrote in the Reporter, he talks about that experience, and he relates it to the experience of what happened at Fenway Park and how he understands how the impact of a word meant to hurt somebody can hurt somebody. And I'd invite people who aren't familiar with Mike. Many people in Dorchester are, because he comes to their civic meetings and tells them what's going on, and he's a very nice guy. He writes in the Reporter this week, it's on the cover, and that's no accident. It's a very very strong piece that he wrote.
Yeah, you just wonder how much of this stuff comes back to Donald Trump. The environment in the United States, the rhetoric of hatred. WBUR reporter Simone Rios was interviewing people about the racial climate in Boston today, and one of the
yeah.
people he interviewed today used a racial slur for being recorded for broadcast. And then I think it was the Boston Globe today reported that on the MBTA there's a lot of
graffiti.
I mean, now, to the MBTA's credit, they're taking the buses and trains out of service and cleaning the graffiti off. I want to say back in the 70s and the 80s, that graffiti just kind of stayed there when you were coming through like different parts
of
the city.
It did, and it would stay on graffiti on rocks and pavement, and it wasn't just moving objects. So
we've come a long way, but we've got a long way to go.
No doubt. Let's turn to another story that's in the banner today, and it deals with the hiring of teachers of color and whether they're also being retained in the school system. You interviewed somebody who's really expert in this field.
Travis Bristol, he's a Boston University professor, and I did a Q&A with him, so just, recorded his answers. And, he does really fascinating work, so sort of got into some of the issues. I mean, he said that Boston is doing a better job than most cities at thinking about how do we hire and retain teachers of color. Some of the problems that you run into is, black teachers will want to come and work in the toughest schools. Those schools don't perform well. The students, don't perform well. And as Travis mentioned, they're under-resourced. Mm. So as a teacher, as a beginning teacher, you're not having like the kinds of successes that it takes for you to make like tenure as a teacher. So a lot of black teachers get screened out at the beginning because they're taking on some of the toughest challenges.
And he's been quantifying this in his research.
Yeah, there's a lot of research out there that does quantify a lot of this stuff. So he's looking into this stuff. There aren't a lot of there aren't as many answers as you'd expect in this stuff a lot of the research is kind of new. People are looking into it. I asked him about programs where, some charters in different states have their own kind of teacher training, and so they'll give you a degree. It's not an accredited university, but they'll give you like something that's somewhat the equivalent of a master's degree, minus you're not paying $62,000 a year to taking on that kind of debt. But the kind of training is kind of really narrowly circumscribed. A lot of the sort of more corporate model of education, the teacher training is just basically how to discipline kids, how to get them to sit in their seats and look straight ahead. So, he got into that a little bit as well. It's a tough choice. Are you going to take on $62,000 of debt, or are you going to go through this program that's going to cost you a lot less and have a job guaranteed at the end of the tunnel there?
Another relevant story and one that it fits into the context of this ongoing BTU City of Boston contract agreement or non-agreement at the moment. So check that out in the banner. I want to just wrap up quickly with this weekend is the Haitian Unity Parade in Mattapan. If you haven't been before, it starts in Mattapan Square and runs up Blue Hill Avenue to Talbot Ave. It starts at 1 o'clock on Sunday. So, A, be careful if you're driving around because it is going to result in road closures and detours. But, B, if you haven't been, and it looks like it's going to be a nice day, it's a great event. It's a fun day. It's a family-oriented event. So definitely check it out. You can find out more details about it at The Reporter and The Banner this week, both newspapers, .news.com and BayStateBanner.com. That's it this week from Front Page Boston. Thank you for joining us. I'm Bill Forey.
I'm Yahoo Miller with the Bay State Banner.
See you next week.